or if not, to at least do this in your mind. I want you to write down a little list for me. When we study the Bible, and especially when we think about parts of the Bible that we really like to study, probably all of us have favorite books. A lot of people I talk to really like to go to the book of Psalms when they want to just read something that will encourage them. Or there may be a particular New Testament book that really stands out as a favorite for you. There are other books we think of as difficult books. And while we don't look at them as something we want to avoid studying, we realize that there's some hard things about them. Probably some of the Old Testament prophets and the book of Revelation and a few like that would fall into that category. But I want you to keep going down your list then for just a little bit and thinking about books. And think about, if we'll really be honest with ourselves, books of the Bible that you think of as boring books. Books that we wouldn't really choose as our favorite reading if we wanted to just open the Bible up and start reading. Now I know that we should study the whole Bible and that there are lessons to be learned throughout it and so on. But I think if we're honest with ourselves, there are some books that just don't excite us as much as others. And I'd like for you to, on your piece of paper, to write down the 5 most boring books in the Bible for you. And don't worry, we're not going to take these up. Nobody else is going to know. Just want you to think about that for a moment. And while you're doing that, let me make a couple of comments on another subject. I want to express, I'm starting to say my, but our gratitude for the opportunity that we've had to be with you this weekend. Anita and I both enjoyed it a great deal. We've appreciated the hospitality that many of you have extended toward us. It's been especially enjoyable to be able to kind of renew some old acquaintances. We enjoy your kindness and your interest in our work in Cincinnati and in Bay City, and would especially ask you to continue to keep us in your prayers and to remember some of the brethren that are meeting in other places. Some of us who grew up in areas like this, I think a lot of times may fail to realize what some of those people go through. And let's try to remember them in our prayers in that respect. Well, we very much enjoyed the opportunity to be with you. And I encourage you this evening, if you've got a Bible with you, to take it out. We're going to be looking at some very simple lessons, but some valuable ones, from some books that just might be on that list that you've been jotting down. How many, I won't ask for a show of hands, but I want you to look at your own and think about it. Did you find somewhere in that list of the top 5 most boring books the book Deuteronomy? Leviticus usually goes hand in hand with that. If Deuteronomy happens to be on your list, then you're right up my alley. If you've got on that list the book of Numbers somewhere in the top 5, then you've hit the other one I want to talk about tonight. Because those are the 2 books that I'd like for us to look at some lessons that are taken from them. And I'll have to admit, those would be somewhere in the top 5 on my own list, I think. We think of Deuteronomy and Leviticus together with all the listings of the laws that the children of Israel were to follow. And we start reading through that, and there's some good material in there, and I think we all recognize that. We have a tendency to think of it as somewhat dry. And with Numbers, the account there of the travels of the children of Israel and so on, and the numbering of the people and all that, seems sometimes to be rather boring reading. But if you'll turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 1, I'd like for us to get a point here that will introduce the lesson, and then go back to the book of Numbers for some very valuable lessons that we can learn from these books that we probably don't spend a whole lot of time in recreational reading or reading just for the enjoyment. Deuteronomy chapter 1 says in verse 1, "These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel on this side of the Jordan in the wilderness, in the plain opposite Suf, between Paran, Tophel, Laban, Hazeroth, and Dizahab. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. Now it came to pass in the 40th year, in the 11th month, on the first day of the month, that Moses spoke to the children of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him as commandments to them. After he had killed Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt in Heshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, who dwelt at Ashtaroth in Edrei. On this side of the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses began to explain this law, saying," and it goes on then with his recounting of what God had given to them in the law. There's a little statement there in verse 2 that I want us to concentrate on, because I think there's a very valuable lesson for us in that. It says, "It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea." I don't know how many times most of us have probably read through and read over that statement and never gave it a second thought. But in that one little verse is a tremendous lesson for us about the kind of development that should take place in our lives as Christians. A lot of times when I do this study, I use an overhead transparency with a projector But I've tried to sketch this on the board tonight. Before you chuckle too much about my artwork, I'll relate an incident that happened at home a couple years back. I was doing some lessons on the Book of Revelation. We got to the throne scene with the 24 elders and the thrones around and the four living creatures and all that. And I went into the building beforehand, and we've got one of those whiteboards that you can use the different colored markers on. And I tried to sketch that whole thing out, and some of the young children came in. We have a drill class for the kids for about 20 minutes before the evening services. And some of the youngsters came in, and they started to erase it because they thought some of the kids had been up scribbling on the board. So it can't be too much worse than that. But let me try to illustrate here what it is that's being talked about in this journey. The Israelites, coming out of Egypt, had crossed the Red Sea and made their way down to Mount Horeb, or Sinai, as we would think of it probably more commonly. From Sinai then, after the receiving of the law, they went on up along the mountains of Seir, this is a mountain range running along here, and up to Kadesh Barnea. From there the spies were sent out into the land and came back with their report. And we'll get into some more of the story later, but you're familiar then with the wanderings for 40 years until that generation had all died off, and then finally they progressed on and crossed into the Promised Land. Now, it's this part of the journey between Horeb and Kadesh Barnea that I want us to concentrate on this evening. It was an 11 days journey, about 165 miles, and on foot, covering about 15 miles a day. It could have been covered or accomplished in about 11 days. But it didn't take 11 days for the Israelites to make that trip. It took them a whole lot longer. If you'll turn with me back to the book of back to the book of Numbers, we're going to look at some of the reasons why they were delayed. Beginning in chapter 10, the Israelites could have made the trip in 11 days, but it took more like 40 days. And the reason is very simple. There was something that they were dragging along with them that slowed them down. Instead of just heading straight to Kadesh Barnea, they were trying to pull something along that they didn't want to let go of. And because of that, the trip took more than about four times as long as it should have, because of some delays that didn't have to happen. I'd like us tonight to look at those delays so that they won't happen in our progress as Christians. In Numbers chapter 10, we find the first reason that they were delayed. In verse 33, it says, "So they departed from the mountain of the Lord," that would be Horeb or Sinai, "on a journey of 3 days, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them." So they headed up the road, they were going a 3-day journey, and then they were going to stop again and set up camp there. Okay, simple enough. 3 days down, 8 to go, it would seem. But then notice what happens as we go on into the 11th chapter. Verse 1 says, "Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord, for the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused, so the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some in the outskirts of the camp." Down to verse 4, it goes on and says, "Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving, so the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat?" They got 3 days down the road, they set up camp, and they were delayed by complaints. Here they are saying, "Who's going to feed us? What are we going to eat?" And they start through this routine that seems to be so common among the Israelites on this trip, complaining about their circumstances. But look what that complaining cost them. In chapter 11 at verse 18, it says, "Then you shall say to the people," God here is giving the instructions of what was going to happen, "sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat not 1 day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have despised the Lord who is among you and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever come up out of Egypt?" I think that's kind of the definition of poetic justice. They're complaining about not having enough to eat, and the Lord said, you're going to have so much you're sick of it. And you're going to eat it not for just a day or so, but you already traveled 3 days, and now you're going to have a delay of a month. And we'll just call that 30 days there. So this journey that could have been done in 11 days has already taken 33 days, and they're not even halfway there. As we go on a little bit later, notice in verse 33 of this chapter, it says, "But while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaava, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. For 33 days, some of them lose their lives there, and all of them become sick of this meat that the Lord provided for them. And that delay was simply because they were dragging something along. They were still wanting to participate in things that were wrong, that were sinful, complaining against the God who just a matter of weeks before had delivered them from the bondage of Egypt. You'd think that would be enough to teach them a lesson. But these people were almost as stubborn as some of us are. They didn't learn the lesson so quickly. Come down to chapter 12, and we notice, first of all, the end of chapter 11, that they moved to Hazeroth and camped at Hazeroth. So they head on up the road a little further. And in chapter 12, verse 1, then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? And the Lord heard it. And here starts the second of their delays, this one being brought on by a problem of controversy. And what happened, if you remember back to Moses, the account of Moses' childhood, remember that Miriam was the older sister, was given the responsibility of watching him. And if we remember then when Moses was called, in about chapter 7 of Exodus, Aaron was sent along as a spokesman, and we're told that Aaron was about 3 years older than Moses. So here's his older sister and older brother who are saying, what's our kid brother doing here? Something like the criticisms that Jesus received when he was in his own territory. We know this fella. His father's a carpenter, and we know his brothers and all that. They're saying, what's our kid brother doing here? He's claiming to have all this authority. Doesn't God speak to us too? And they were challenging Moses' authority, challenging whether Moses was really God's only and exclusive servant and messenger in this account. In chapter 12, verse 3, it says, now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. That's quite a compliment that's paid to him here. It goes on and says in verse 4, suddenly the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. Then he said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision, and I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? God says, you're not challenging Moses' authority. You're challenging my authority. And the basis of this controversy is that you're challenging me. And there's a lesson in that we're going to look at in a little while. As we go on then, we see the account of the anger of the Lord was aroused against them in verse 9. And he departed. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. So Aaron said to Moses, O my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly and in which we have sinned. Please do not let her be as one dead, whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb. So Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. Then the Lord said to Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed for 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and after that she may be received again. Now we don't know exactly how far and how long they had traveled before this stop, but we'll add that in a little later. But we've got another 7-day delay here, because look in verse 15. So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey on till Miriam was brought in again. Another 7-day delay, because they're still dragging sin along, weighting them down, holding them back. Well, as we go on then, over a little bit later, we come into chapter 13, and we find they made the trip on to Kadesh Barnea. They covered the rest of the territory. So we'll figure that in as 8 more days of actual travel time that was involved. And we come up with a total there of something in the neighborhood of 48 days to make an 11-day journey, because they were dragging sin along. And you would think from all this, they would have learned their lesson, and they would have gotten to Kadesh Barnea and headed straight on as quickly as they could into the Promised Land. But it still didn't work that way. They make this 11-day journey, and instead of on the 12th day heading on toward their destination, Let's look at what happens as we get over to chapter 13. They send out the spies. I don't know exactly what route they followed. I didn't try to look all that up, and I'm not sure that it's even recorded for us. But they sent the spies on into the promised land to see what it was like and spy out the land. And they came back, and we're all familiar with the basics of this account, with a report where 10 of them gave a negative report and 2 argued in favor of going on, that by God's power they would be able to take the land. In chapter 13, verse 27, it says, "Then they told him and said, 'We went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites, the Jebusites, and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. And the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan.' Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it.'" There is the argument from the other side. "But the men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak came from the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight.'" We can't do it. We can't conquer the land. And so the spies give the bad report, and the people are delayed again, not getting beyond that 11th day, this time because of cowardice. You remember as we go on about how the people as a whole heard these reports and they accepted the negative report, chose not to go on. Chapter 14, verse 11 uses an interesting description of that. It says, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'How long will these people reject me, and how long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them?'" That would have been a good one to throw in this morning if we'd had more time, talking about the strength of God. God said, "They're denying my strength. I've shown them all these signs, and they don't believe that I can help them conquer the land." And then in verse 32 of chapter 14, we find God's sentence. "But as for you, your carcasses shall fall in this wilderness, and your sons shall be shepherds in the wilderness 40 years, and bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness. According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. I, the Lord, have spoken this. I will surely do so to all this evil congregation who are gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be consumed, and there they shall die." The account in Deuteronomy talked about 11 days. But I want us to think now about a trip that maybe if they had gone directly to the promised land would have been a trip of 25 or 30 days. Not only did it take them the 48 days to get this far, but we can add to that another 40 years before any of them got onto the promised land and recognized that many of them never made it because they carried something with them that they should have gotten rid of back here when they crossed the Red Sea. They were dragging sin along. Now, I realize that that's all the boring stuff from Deuteronomy and Numbers, but I'd like for us to go on to something that might be a little bit more interesting and notice some parallels of this to our own lives and our own development as Christians. You know, the New Testament often uses the Israelites as an example for us to learn from. In 1 Corinthians 10 is one of the most vivid patterns of that kind of an example, because what he does is he starts back here at the Red Sea with the children of Israel crossing the Red Sea, and he describes it as their baptism, that they were baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And so that, I think, we can see a pretty clear comparison to our baptism. As they left the bondage of Egypt, when we are baptized into Christ, we are leaving the bondage of sin and going out to a new life. But we're not suddenly in the promised land, and they weren't either. They had to go through this wilderness, this desert land, before they were going to reach the promised land. And there were a lot of trials in that wilderness. And before we reach the promised land and stand on Jordan's stormy banks and cast our wistful eye and cross over the Jordan to that promised land, we've got to go through the desert too. We have to go through the wilderness. And 1 Corinthians 10 uses that as an example, that just like they fell in the wilderness, we can fall in the wilderness and make those kinds of mistakes. with that as the basic parallel, I want us to focus on our lives between Horeb and Kadesh Barnea. If we will think of Horeb, since it was the place where they received the law, as the place where we received God's will for us. And we can think of part of that as being at the time of our baptism. We learn the basics of the gospel. But then we continue to learn that we have other basic responsibilities as Christians. And having heard those, we have to put them into action and grow and get up here to the point that we're ready to launch the attack, ready to cross over. In this case, they've sent out spies, but then we're ready to make the final approach to go on to the promised land. And if we can compare this trip of 11 days to the time that we need in growing up, and I'm not saying the Christian matures in 11 days by any means, but let's use the comparison, the idea that we can make the trip and can make progress, can grow up, can live the rest of our lives, make the rest of our journey as basically mature people, mature Christians, and be ready to cross over. Now, we'll keep growing during this time as well. We should keep growing throughout our lives. But we need to develop ourselves to reach a point that we can be viewed as being spiritually mature. And we can do that, can do it in a relatively short time, unless we're trying to drag sin along. And I'd like for us to think about how some of these very sins can hold us back and keep us from growing as we should. What about complaining? That was what held them back when they complained about not having the food they wanted. Rather than getting on the road and getting over there to the promised land to receive the blessings that were there, this terrific land that they've been told about, they were complaining about right here and right now and how terrible things were. And I believe sometimes when we get our eyes off of the goal that we're supposed to be going toward, it's easy to look around us at all the problems that we have, everything we can find fault with, and start complaining about it. And these lessons and the things that will hold us back, I believe, can be applied in two ways. First of all, in our own lives as individuals, how will I let these things delay my growth as a Christian? And secondly, in our work together as a local church, how will we let these kinds of problems delay our progress, our development, our spiritual growth in a local church? And complaining, I believe, is one that all of us have to deal with in our own lives and in our association together with one another. Do we slow down or totally stop our development as Christians because we're grumbling and griping and complaining and bitter about everything around us? Sometimes we see people, and maybe see them in the mirror, who just are sour about everything that goes on. And that's not to suggest that there are not some negatives involved in our service as Christians. Even in our preaching and our teaching, there are some negatives. There are some don'ts. There are some things we have to get rid of. But that doesn't mean that our disposition toward life and toward other people is to be one to be negative and just finding fault with everything we can. I think all of us have known of Christians who have remained spiritual infants, maybe all their lives, because they spent more time griping than growing. And we need to be careful that that's not the person we see in the mirror in the morning. It's not a person who's so busy finding faults around us that we can't keep the eyes on the goal and reach toward it and move toward it. You know, the Israelites lived in some conditions, especially on this trip, we're not always perfect. I don't know how many of us get into hiking or that sort of thing very much, but imagine taking even that little 11-day trip along the mountain range. I'm sure that wasn't the easiest thing to do with 600,000 men and their women and children and so on. They had quite a trip involved in that. Their circumstances were certainly not anything perfect, and our lives are going to have the rough spots. But that doesn't excuse griping and complaining about everything that goes on, finding fault with our circumstances. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10 that I mentioned there a moment ago, one of the big ones that Paul points out that the Israelites did that we're supposed to learn from is this very problem. He says in verse 10 of that chapter, "Nor murmur, as some of them also murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer." Seemingly a direct allusion to the incident we looked at with their complaining. Don't be murmuring. And that means, a very simple application, so we're not going to be always looking for things that we can find fault with. In our work as a local church, we're not going to always be going around complaining because we didn't like this, we didn't like that, what was going on within the congregation. We're going to try to find the things that are good and develop those. If we see faults, rather than griping about them, let's help correct them. Use our energies in a constructive way, not in one that's going to hold us back and keep us away from that promised land. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 14, it's another passage that I think can help us to understand that we can't let these things hold us back. He says, "Do all things without murmuring and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world." Notice the context of that passage. Go back two verses to verse 12, and it's the one we quote so often about working out our own salvation with fear and trembling. You go back a few more, verses 5 through 11 are showing us that we need to emulate the humility of Jesus Christ. And as he was willing to make himself lower than people to die for them, to become despised among men, we need to be willing to make ourselves lower than the person that's next to us. Look up to him instead of down on him. Instead of finding faults with him, let's look to our own faults first and try to build him up and make him a better person. And to have the attitude of humility that Jesus Christ had. If we emulate that attitude, it'll be a lot harder for us to find the time for the complaining about everything around us. In the book of Jude, probably wasn't on anybody's list tonight. One of those we almost forget about being in there sometimes because it's so short. But in Jude, at verse 15, another statement that may help us, speaks here about the Lord coming to execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds, which they have committed in an ungodly way. One of the most ungodly verses in the Bible. And of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him, these are, verse 16, murmurers, complainers, walking according to their own lusts, and they mouth great swelling words, flattering people to gain advantage. If your disposition of life is such to go around complaining and griping about nearly everything that happens, the Bible talks about you very specifically. And I don't think any of us like the description that's given there. He says the Lord is coming to execute wrath on complainers and murmurers. That's not the kind of lives we want to live. And we don't want to have that complaining holding us back as we're developing as Christians and growing as a church. It's something that we need to get rid of. If we don't like the food, we can put up with it. We're not going to be here forever. We're going to finally get to a better land if we prepare ourselves properly for it. But kind of going hand in hand with that, and if we can get rid of the complaining, the next one is the problem of controversy. And sometimes they fit together, but there may be cases where it's not all brought about by the same thing. I want to mention, first of all, that there is nothing wrong with brethren differing with one another if they deal with the differences properly and scripturally. We're going to disagree about things. We're going to understand things differently. If it's something that really matters and we'll have the right kind of an attitude, I believe we're going to be able to find scriptural answers to where we can come to agreement. And I'll give an illustration of that that kind of etched in my memory, I think, forever. There's a man that I don't think I won't say I never could, but he'd have to do an awful lot for me to lose respect for him. When we started the congregation in Cincinnati, this is something that's kind of new to me, coming from this general area. But one of the biggest problems in Cincinnati is an issue over whether or not women can teach a Bible class of children or other women. And I had never seen much of that when I was growing up. It's quite an issue in that area. And about half of the churches that I know of in that area don't use women to teach Bible classes. Now, the church where I was preaching before we started this work did not use them. And there was division within the group as to the attitudes, the opinions about it, and the approach of the elders was that they weren't going to force that over somebody's objection. And there were some conscientious objections within the group. Well, when we started, we kind of got an opinion what the different ones viewed, and we found out there were some in that group who had a conscientious objection to it. So we agreed at the outset that we would not use women teachers, but every chance that came up, we encouraged study of it. And there was one man, basically, that objected pretty strongly to that. And so, when one time we suggested that maybe we could use some women in some of the classes, and he objected, we said, okay, we respect your objection, but let's study about it. Anybody who's interested, let's get together and study about it. And so we set the guidelines of, I think, 45-minute discussion periods, and decided that we would get a list of questions, and we would agree on the first before we'd go on to the second, go right down the line. And this man came in with a sincere objection that he did not know that the Bible authorized the use of women teachers, even for children. After the fourth session of 45 minutes, that man was saying, okay, now that we recognize that this is authorized, how are we going to present this to the other members of the congregation who may not have been here for these discussions? It was a matter that nobody was trying to force an opinion or push somebody to believing, but we're trying to go into it with open minds. And I'll tell you, I've got a lot of respect for a man with a mind that's open that can get to the point that he says, okay, I'm convinced, now let's teach others. And he right now is about the strongest advocate of women teachers that we've got in the group. Because he changed, he was convinced. But we're not always going to agree. Matters that may not really matter, they come into the realm of judgment. And we need to there have the attitude of humility that Philippians 2 talked about. If it's a matter of judgment that doesn't really matter, let's be willing in some of those cases to give in, not to have the controversy over that. What it comes down to in most of the controversies that divide us from one another in churches is the same problem that happened back then in the book of Numbers. Miriam and Aaron were challenging the authority of what Moses was saying and were in reality challenging God's authority. If our differences are because we're challenging God's authority, then there's something wrong, and it's going to hold us back. Controversy will be a weight that we'll have to drag along, and Kadesh Barnea is going to be a long trip for us to make. Too many Christians stunt their growth, delay their development by becoming wrapped up in these kinds of controversies. The battles become matters of personalities and personal opinions, rather than of really defending the truth and being united as an army doing that. And it's no wonder sometimes that we are not more effective than we are in reaching the lost if what they see is a bunch of people, instead of being lights in the world, without murmuring and complaining and controversy, are too busy fighting with each other over things that don't really matter. I heard of a church in Michigan, maybe I shouldn't say this since that's where I'm wanting to move, 100 and some miles from where I'm planning to move, that divided over an issue of whether or not men with beards could be allowed to wait on the table. That's pathetic. That's sick. For that kind of thing, that kind of controversy, to hold back the progress of the gospel. We need to be careful that we don't allow that kind of pettiness to be a part of our lives. That we don't allow ourselves to be held back by fighting over things that don't matter. Because people like that stay children a long time. They may never get to Kadesh Barnea. And if they do, they may never get onto the promised land. Well, if we get rid of that one, and we're not going to be held back by controversy, what about the problem of cowardice that's involved? Now, if we go back to that account that was there in Numbers, remember what we read, the first problem they had of the cowardice was basically what you could call some spineless spies that said, we're like grasshoppers in our own sight, and in their sight, we can't overtake them. Sometimes that's called the grasshopper complex, that I'm just not big enough to do the job. The second problem was when the people heard all this, they didn't believe, what we could call skepticism. They were skeptics or unbelievers, didn't trust in the power of God. And I believe those same two problems can hold us back today. The spineless spies were overcome by their own inabilities. Instead of saying what we can do through God who strengthens us, like Paul in Philippians 4, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. They said, we're like grasshoppers and they're giants. We don't have a chance. Can't overcome them. We can't do it. And that same thing will hold us back as Christians. It'll keep us back in our seats when we could be out doing things for the Lord. It'll keep us back looking for excuses and trying to find somebody else who's stronger and mightier than we are because we're afraid to do the job. It'll keep small churches small because we're going to be afraid to go out and tackle the real jobs that are there. Now, I'll give another thought related to that. When you look at the examples of conversions in the book of Acts, you notice how many times the apostles and the teachers and preachers in the first century really went after the big fish, if you will, went after the magistrate of the city. When was the last time, I don't know, Payton City is a little smaller than, say, Cincinnati, when was the last time we went trying to convert the mayor, trying to reach somebody that we think of as being somewhat powerful? When was the last time that, as Paul was right there in the presence of those in Rome and kept working on those of even the Praetorian Guard, some of the more powerful ones, apparently in the military there. When was the last time we tried to reach people that were in places of power and influence? I realize that those are not always easy people to reach, and we may not have a very high success rate, but do we try? Or are we grasshoppers in our own sight, and they're giants that we're not even going to touch? Are we going to write them off and never give them a chance even to say no to the gospel because we're too busy looking for the easy ones, the smaller ones. Sometimes I think we need to think a little bigger in our work as Christians and realize that we've got a hold of something here that has had the power to change the vilest men that have ever lived, has the power to change the world. Let's let the power loose. Let's use it. And I'm not talking about something where we're going to go out and turn the world in flip-flops overnight. But you know, the apostles, in a fairly short time, were accused of having turned the world upside down with the doctrine they were preaching. We've got the same doctrine. We've got the same word there, if we can get it out of our minds that we're grasshoppers. And the same thing is true in much of our other development, our growth, that we need to set some goals that will demand something of us, to plan to progress and to develop ourselves as Christians. Young men, and I'm talking way down to the really young ones. Maybe you've just recently obeyed the gospel. Maybe you haven't even gotten that far yet. But what are you planning to do spiritually with your life? Have you given thought to the idea not only of being a Christian, but of being qualified to serve as a deacon, or better yet, someday to serve as an elder? And what are you doing to get there? I can be thankful. You knew them some way, maybe as well as I did in some respects. And I wouldn't by any means claim my parents to be perfect, just like I sure wouldn't claim to be a perfect parent. But I can sure be appreciative of the fact that we were given the encouragement in the home to set the priorities of our service to God. I was talking with Roger this afternoon, just being back in Page City brought back a memory. We were talking about Barney Winland, who baptized me here, I guess 14 years, 15 years ago, something like that. And I was telling him about an incident that day when I went home that morning and Mom was fixing dinner in the kitchen. I was in there talking with her and I said, "That's one of three." She didn't have to ask me what it was. She said, "The next one is you want to be a preacher and the next one is you want to be an elder." And I said, "Yeah, that's what I've got in mind." Well, I got to number two and I got a long way to go for number three, but the goal's still there. Young men, plan to use your life to reach some goals. And that's not to exclude the other gender. Young ladies, just because you will not serve as an elder in the Lord's church or won't be a gospel preacher doesn't mean that you can sit back and do nothing. There are men like those who need good wives, and a lot of times there are too few of them to go around. There are a lot of things that a woman can do in the service of the Lord: teaching, reaching other people, helping them understand the gospel, showing the kind of hospitality that Christians are supposed to show to one another. Let's set goals that demand something of ourselves. When I was in seventh grade math, I don't know if he's still around or not, but Mr. Vanscoy was the math teacher I had here. Some of you may have had the pleasure of sitting in his classes too, I don't know. But he used an illustration one time in class and he said that we can set a goal for ourselves and we can try to reach the moon. Or we can set a goal and we can try to reach the treetops. Or we can set a goal and we can be content with the mud puddle. He said, if we go for the moon and we miss, we might at least land in the treetops. If we go for the treetops and we miss, we're going to be in the mud puddle. And he was saying, set the goals high and reach for them. Let's set goals that demand something of us spiritually. Demand that we really work and develop ourselves. That we spend time studying that book and applying it in our lives. I think we're too often content with ignorance of God's work. Of God's word, rather, being inadequate to do his work. Just a general spiritual mediocrity that we'll just be a face in the crowd, and that's not what God's asking of us. He's given us the potential to thoroughly furnish us to every good work. Let's use it, and let's develop ourselves in that way. Something that I ran across not too long ago that got me thinking about this. Sometimes I think, especially as we're young, we have a tendency to think, well, we've got all the time in the world. And in some ways, we may have time ahead of us that we can use. But I'm afraid too often we're wasting what time we have, not really planning to use our time and develop ourselves. We think about years ahead of us, and if we work with an average life expectancy of 70 years, and I know there's some in here who have gone quite a bit further than that. My great Aunt Mary lived with us for a while. She celebrated her 96th last year. We're already planning the reunion at her 100th birthday. She keeps going pretty strong, and we figure that would be a time to make a trip to Florida. But let's just work with 70 years as an average life expectancy. If you're 20 years old, that seems like 50 years off, a long time away, because a year seems like such a long time. But you know, a week or a month Doesn't seem like so long, does it? A month ago, that was just almost like yesterday. Last week, that probably just flew by like that. So let's think of it in terms for a little bit of weeks or months. If you're 20 years old, you have an average expectancy of 600 months. To me, that doesn't sound like so long. Because those months go by in no time at all. And 600 of them can just whiz right by. Or if you'd rather do it in weeks, you've got about 2,600 weeks ahead of you. And those weeks just really disappear. What are we going to do with that time that we have, with those weeks that we have? If you're 30 years old, climbing up the mountain just a little bit higher, you've got about 480 months, or a little over 2,000 weeks, yet to go. That doesn't sound like quite so long either. And if you've hit what we call middle age, at 40, say, you've got about 360 months to plan on if you enjoy a normal life expectancy. And we don't even have that to plan on. We don't know that we have that. 360 months, or a little over 1,500 weeks. Starts to get kind of short, doesn't it? I'll stop after 50. You can figure it out from there if you want to go beyond that. If you're 50 and shooting for 70, and if you make it, you're down to the last 240 months, or 1,040 weeks. Think about how quickly last week went. You got 1,000 of them left, if you enjoy a normal lifespan. We need to plan to use that time. Am I going to be stronger a week from now or a month from now than I am today? Am I going to make the progress and set the goals and work toward them? Or am I going to let my own spinelessness, my own preoccupation with my inabilities, hold me back to where I'm just a grasshopper that can't do anything? That's not what God's looking for. But there was another problem they had, and that was the skepticism. If they had recognized their own power, they still would have said, we can't take the land, because they probably couldn't by their own power. But they also forgot about the fact that God had delivered them from the Egyptians, that had held them in bondage for 400 years, had brought them through the wilderness to this point, and was now ready to send them on this final assault into the promised land. But they had a skepticism about God. They doubted God. When we're content with less than God requests, and we don't want to build and work and reach those goals, we're indicating really that we don't believe God has the ability to help us change to fit His mold. We sing that song, Have Thine Own Way, Lord. Mold me and make me after Thy will. Do we believe it? Are we really willing to submit ourselves and say, do with me as you will? Do we believe in the power of God to change us? Paul did. He went from one who was a destroyer of God's word, God's work, to a defender of His word. He went from one who was a persecutor to a preacher, an adversary to an apostle. He made the change, a tremendous change. We talked this morning in the class about some of the changes in Peter's life, the development that took place in his life. Those men put the trust in God that He could help them change, and they did their part. Will we do ours? Otherwise, if we fail to, it'll hold us back. We really live it when we say, have thine own way, Lord. As we look at some problems like this and some cowardice that we have to face, that we have to deal with in our own lives, are we afraid to attack our opponents head on? And I don't mean getting into a fight. We already got rid of the controversy part of it. But the opponents that would stand between us and our spiritual development and our reaching of that goal in heaven, the obstacles that are between here and heaven, will we take them head on? Will we deal with those and realize that God has the power to help us do it? Or will we be grasshoppers in our own eyes and give up and convince ourselves we just can never do it? To try to put it back into our setting in the book of Numbers, and to realize that we have to get rid of the cowardice and everything that goes with it. If we were among those 12 spies, how would we be remembered in history? If you were one of those 12, what would your name be in that list? If you had to assume one of their names, would you be a Shaphat or a Caleb? An Amiel or a Joshua? Two of those names a little unfamiliar? It's because they are some of the 10 cowards. The 10 who would not do what God said. We remember Joshua and Caleb because they had the strength and the trust in God to stand up for what was right. And of all the 600,000 men that left that bondage, they were the only two that entered the promised land. We may have received God's will, as they did at Mount Horeb. How long will it take us to get to Kadesh Barnea? Will we travel that road and reach spiritual maturity and go beyond that into the promised land of heaven? Or will we be held back by sins that would keep us back and prevent us from entering that? How long will the journey take us? 11 days? 48 days as they spent? A few months? A few years? Or like most of those in the wilderness who never got beyond, will we never make it? It's up to us. God has given us the power to do it. We have to decide to use it. In Hebrews chapter 12, using the examples of those of faith in the Old Testament in chapter 11, the writer goes on in chapter 12 to use that as an example to encourage us in dealing with this very problem. And just like these things that they held on to that held them back, he said there in verse 1 of chapter 12, "Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." We've got a road to travel, a trip to make. Let's get rid of the weights and make the trip. As individual Christians, as we work together in a local church, let's live by the pattern that's given there and realize that God has the power to help us change. Let's get rid of the weights of sin and not be held back by the complaining and the cowardice and the controversy and the failure to follow the pattern that God has given us. We're going to stand in just a moment and sing a song of invitation. It's an encouragement to you, if you're in the audience this evening and you're not a Christian, to make that decision to be obedient to the gospel of Christ. You know, he doesn't say that you have to know everything. The Israelites, we want to draw a comparison, didn't even receive the basic laws of God until after they got out of the land. There were a lot of things they had to learn. And while they had some things they had to know before they could cross that Red Sea, there was a lot for them to learn. When you first obey the gospel, there will still be a lot to learn. He doesn't say that we have to know it all before we can be Christians. But he does say we have to cross out of that bondage of sin and head on toward the promised land. We have to get rid of it. And just as the baptism in the cloud and in the sea removed them from the bondage of Egypt, baptism in water into Jesus Christ will remove us from the bondage of sin. It may be that you've already done that, but somewhere along this road, you've gotten slowed down. Maybe it's the grumbling and complaining. Maybe it's the strife and the fighting. Maybe it's just the cowardice, that we won't really launch out into the deep and do the job that God's given us to do. And maybe it's holding you back. Maybe it's held you back so much that it's a matter that needs to be corrected before your brethren here. If that's the case, don't delay it any longer. You know, if you wait another week, that's 1 week less that you've got to do that. And those weeks, there aren't that many of them coming. Take advantage of the opportunity that you have now. Start on the trip and set your face toward Kadesh Barnea and decide to get there, to reach a degree of spiritual maturity and go on to the promised land. There's too much time wasted if we put it off. And we don't have any assurance of how much time we have to work with. If you need to answer the Lord's call of invitation, we'd invite you to come and take a seat at the front as we stand and sing.